Rock Podcast, talking all things Disney with your hosts, Eljon Go and Dave Bossert.
Welcome to Skull Rock Podcast. Yes, and happy post-Easter to you. I hope you found a lot of Easter eggs. Hope the Easter Bunny was kind to you. And every week, we talk all things Disney, pop culture, and so much more behind the scenes of your favorite movies, animators, Imagineers, theme park attractions, performances, books. Man, we run the gambit here on the show. And I am your co-host, Eljon Go, longtime Marvel, Disney, and Star Wars fan, also musician, podcaster. We wear a lot of hats here. You can email me, Eljon, A-L-J-O-N, at skullrockpodcast.com.
And I'm your other co-host, Dave Bossert, artist, filmmaker, author, and welcome to the Skull Rock Podcast. If you love Disney and pop culture, please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform, as well as like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Wow. And you can also email me at dave@skullrockpodcast.com. Eljon,
yes,
it's springtime. The weather has really turned out here in Los Angeles. Yeah. I mean, we've had a little run of 80-degree weather. I've been in the backyard doing some gardening, planting flowers. I'm hoping that the rain and the bad weather has passed you by at this point.
I hope so. We're experiencing the same. And we have got sun, and it's been great to go for a walk outside. Took the kids, and you're gonna love this. Took the kids for their very first Easter egg hunt here in the neighborhood.
Wow, yeah. That must have been fun.
Yeah, oh my gosh. I mean, I think we call our kids Boo and Jack Jack. You know, that's their Boo and Jack Jack. So Boo was out there, and she was just amazed at all the people because, you know, we've been sheltering in place here. We very seldom go out. Over the last few weeks since Kristen and I had gotten our vaccinations, and we're getting our booster here in a couple weeks, but we actually took the kids out, put them in the grocery, you know, grocery cart. We're going to the grocery store, and they're like, oh my gosh, what is all this? And saying hi to people. So they make friends wherever they go. And of course, they were making friends there in the little play yard there out in our neighborhood, and by the jungle gym and the little swings and everything. So there was all kinds of kids. And I think she was more interested in saying hi and making friends than hunting for Easter eggs, which is completely fine.
and understandable too.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's like, oh, they're kids my age. They're little people out here. So that was really a treat. I'll have to send you some photos, but yeah, they were great.
That's awesome. You know, I'll tell you, it's so magical to have small children and take them like either Halloween trick-or-treating or Easter egg hunts or, you know, any of those kinds of things that are, you know, around holidays. It's just so great to see that innocence, isn't it?
It is. And just the wonder in their eyes and the excitement when they, you know, find an egg or anything like that. But this comes to my next point, Dave. As the world starts opening up, Kristen and I are talking about bringing the kids to Disney for their very first Disney trip.
Wow, yeah. That's exciting. And you know, the parks are all reopening. I mean, we talked about this last week. Disneyland is reopening April 30th. Obviously, Disney World has been open for some time, but SeaWorld in San Antonio, they're going to have their Food Fest returning. And you've got Universal Studios reopening April 16th.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm excited about that. I'm excited to maybe at some point soon bring the kiddos out to see you over there in the left coast. But I tell you what, you alluded to a lot of our headlines, so let's go ahead and jump right into the news. Yeah.
Skull Rock Podcast, ripped from the headlines. It's Skull Rock Podcast headline news.
Eljon, yes. I gotta tell you something.
Yes, sir.
And this isn't this sort of missed our list here, and I think it was because it just came through this morning.
Okay.
But Godzilla versus Kong had a monster opening weekend.
Yay!
So that in and of itself tells me that people are itching to get back into the movie theaters. And, you know, there was more than 3,000 theaters reopened in the United States.
Yeah.
And Godzilla versus Kong did almost $50 million opening weekend, the best box office opening weekend since the pandemic began.
You know what? That is wonderful news. And by all accounts, people are ready to get back into it. They've been vaccinated. They, you know, those are the people that are out there. And still, we encourage everyone to get the vaccination and go out there and just get back to normal and supporting these local theaters and these people and the studios and the all of these people that, you know, there's so many tens of thousands of people that are employed in the entertainment industry, music and food service and entertainment and these theaters and the theater owners. And there's so many people there that need help. And what a great way. And this, I'm encouraged by it. And I look forward to seeing the movie business just blossom, hopefully faster and sooner than later.
Well, if this is any indication, I mean, the worldwide gross over the last week for Godzilla versus Kong is like $285 million. It's fast approaching $300 million globally in a week. And that's just fantastic. And that speaks volumes to the fact that people are going to go back to the movie theaters. And that's where you need to see these big effects extravaganzas, you know, and I'm looking forward to seeing Black Widow in the theater.
Yay, me too. And, we are too. And I think what we're going to do is, since now we have the little ones, we want to try to go out and see Black Widow and do a double feature there at the drive-in theater. So we're going to drive all the way, you know, across several towns and go to the drive-through with the little ones. We're going to have a little picnic and we want to watch Black Widow. And we definitely want to watch Mortal Kombat when it comes out. I mean, it's going to be really, really fun and all that stuff on HBO Max and Disney Plus and Paramount Plus and every plus that's out there. So,
yeah. And the weather is certainly starting to cooperate.
Yeah. I'm loving it. I'm loving it. So I can't wait. It's really nice to get out, breathe some fresh air and feel the sun on your face. It's the little things that you have to enjoy in life.
That's right.
Well, speaking of little things, Dave, and this is a really neat thing for us because we love food and we love the parks. And SeaWorld San Antonio Seven Seas Food Fest returns with globally inspired eats and sips. I love this because I know that you have a touch of Disney going on at Disneyland right now. And it's nice that these things are slowly opening up and giving people an opportunity to sample some really great food and wine.
Yeah, and I love the fact that the theme parks are doing these types of events. I think they're really great. They draw a lot of people in, and they're just fun. It's great to be able to, you know, when you go down to the food and art festival.
Yeah.
What do they call it?
The Festival of the Arts.
Yes, thank you. Festival of the Arts.
We call it the Farts.
I've been to it numerous times.
The Farts Festival.
There you go, the Farts Festival. You know, I just absolutely love it because you just get to wander and sample stuff and just be outside and enjoy yourselves. And I think so many people are looking forward to that coming back.
Absolutely. And I understand that Eat to the Beat concert series at Epcot will be returning back for food and wine this year. So I'm looking forward to that. And I think the other theme parks understand, you know, Knott's Berry and Six Flags, all these parks understand that it's really cool to have these food and wine events where people can sip and stroll and eat and snack around these little areas and go on theme park attractions and just relax and have fun at the theme park. So I'm glad that they're kind of adopting this thing and giving these new culinary experiences to these people, the fans.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, speaking of Universal, Dave, you sent me this as well. You know, Universal Studios is reopening April 16th. So we're just a few weeks away. I can't believe it. So with that, and of course, Disneyland reopening on the 30th, you know, tickets are on sale right now. So I'm looking forward to that. When was the last time you went to Universal, Dave?
Oh my gosh, it's got to be a couple of years now. And I've I got to tell you, the last time I actually went through the theme park is probably a half dozen, 8 years ago. I've gone up there a couple of times because, you know, they have movie theaters and, mm-hmm. and whatnot. And I've seen some films there. They also have the Universal Amphitheater, yeah. which, you know, they've done a number of concerts, a lot of concerts, but I've been to a number of concerts there.
So I have to ask you real quick, have you ever been tapped by Universal to do anything for them? Because I don't think we've ever discussed that.
You know something, when I left Disney, Universal did reach out to me about a project, but they wanted to have me relocate to Florida. Oh. I didn't really want to do that. And okay. also, you know, the sort of been there, done that type of feeling washed over me when they reached out. So, you know, hey, listen. There's plenty of people out there to do some of those gigs, but that particular one just wasn't for me.
I get it. And there are a lot of you know, people involved with the theme parks and in Disney that have gone back and forth over time and worked for Warner Brothers too.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, which, by the way, did you see the Bancroft brothers? I think either Tony, I think, may have posted something about Space Jam, which was great, on his Instagram, yes. which was hilarious.
Yeah, I did see that, where he had Bugs Bunny dunking a ball in a hoop and Mickey down on the floor behind him.
It was hilarious.
I thought that was great.
I thought it was great, too. Well, I tell you, something that's been happening throughout all of fandom is, you know, what's going on with Justice League and Star Wars. And we've talked about this over time, but it seems like there has been a bunch of fans that, you know, really wanted to get the Snyder Cut released, and it seemingly worked. I would think that this is really a fan motivated project, but I know that DC's kind of put the kibosh on some of it, but there's even more to this. Can you expand on this a little bit?
You know, I think this is all touching on the toxic fandom, as they're calling it, mm-hmm. That's, you know, it seems to proliferate throughout, you know, social media as well. You know, it's all on social media. I mean, it's this negative vibe and nasty name calling and all kinds of toxic messages that I just think are just an energy suck. I don't pay much attention to it.
Mm-hmm. I live out there, you know, on YouTube. I'm watching videos and reviews all the time of what people are saying, and I just don't understand why can't people just. Well, I do understand. When you have passion for a franchise or whatever, that's why they're called fans. You know, you're a huge fan, you're a fanatic sometimes, and you love these franchises. You've paid hard-earned money and everything to support these franchises and comic books and different things over the years, and you know, all kinds of collectibles. But it seems to me like, and I'm coming from this from a longtime fan of everything that we talk about here on this show, pop culture. You like what you like, and if you don't like it, you vote with your wallet. And if you want to continue to support people, that's fine. I just hope that people can just accept things and like what they like and appreciate other people for liking what they like. And if the studios make a decision that you don't agree with, or people or actors make things, say something that you don't agree with, that's okay. We can agree to disagree, but you know, you don't have to like it, and that's fine. You don't have to attack your fellow fans about it, because everybody's different, you know?
Listen, I absolutely agree on that. And, you know, there's a lack of decorum on social media. And honestly, a lot of that kind of negativity and nastiness is going to come back and bite those people down the line.
Yeah.
You know, so many employers are now checking people's social media channels to see what they're putting up. And there's been story after story of people not getting jobs because of what they've done on their social media channels. Mm-hmm. So I just think that people need to think about for a moment what they're writing, what they're saying. It's fine to have different opinions, but have decorum, have, you know, be decent about it. You know, say you disagree and why you disagree. Don't, you know, flog the person that you're disagreeing with and beat them with, you know, profanities and nastiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think studios should also learn that the fans, all fans are, you know, support what they're putting out, and that they need to make sure that the fans, the people, are very important. You know, I think all fans are important.
And the fans matter.
The fans matter. Fans matter.
The fans matter, and the studios have to be respectful to the fans.
Yep, they certainly do. And, you know, this is what keeps those properties, those intellectual properties, those tentpole franchises, deeply, deeply popular and in place, and in position to continually have sequels, you know? So anyway, I think that's really the crux of it. You know, but, fans are fans, you know, respect the fan and
respect the fans, but the fans need to respect the creators as well.
Absolutely. It goes both ways. Yeah. I love this. Disney launches 20th Century Television Animation division under Marcy Prosciutto. Did I say that right?
Do you know Prosciutto? Marcy?
Prosciutto?
I think so. Yeah. You know, this was interesting because essentially this is Disney creating a animation division that will deal with adult oriented animation, you know, like the BoJack Horseman and, you know, Bob's Burgers and those types of shows.
I love that. First of all, can I tell you, we were just talking about how much Kristen and I love Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah, he's great.
You know, so I love the fact that, you know, Family Guy and American Dad are going to continue to be created. Obviously, The Simpsons, you know, Bob's Burgers, super fun. And I know that they had at one point a Deadpool animated series that was adult oriented that they might be able to bring back. But, you know, that's great. And I knew it was just a matter of time before they did that and figured things out. So I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, so am I. Yeah. I mean, why not? And it made sense for them to obviously call it 20th Television Animation, because you know, again, they've got so many brands under the Disney umbrella. They do have to differentiate so that they're not tarnishing the Disney name.
Exactly. It's a great place for it, just like the rest of the 20th Century Studios content, you know, the R-rated absolutely. Films, et cetera. But I just can't wait for them to open the floodgates and give us more of the content so I don't have to have a million of these apps. I just want everything open. I just want Disney. Can I just have Disney ever? Okay. And I think one of the other things is we both agree Knives Out was fun, right? Knives Out was fun.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was a great ensemble cast. Again, I'm a big fan of Daniel Craig.
Yes.
And, you know, it was really great to see him in something other than a Bond movie.
No kidding.
And, and you know, to me, he's not typecast. Yeah. He is not typecast at all.
Yeah. I like Knives Out too. And yeah, believe it or not, gang, even for a Star Wars fan, this I do like about Rian Johnson, right? So maybe not Last Jedi, but definitely Knives Out. And I really liked all the characters there. And it looks like Netflix opened up their wallet to a number of $450 million. And doing a trilogy. Is that right? They were doing a lot of movies with Knives Out.
So I think it's fantastic. I think it's a great franchise. I love Daniel Craig's character in that film. Yep. And I'm looking forward to seeing what the sequel is going to be.
Yeah, me too. I think that's going to be really exciting. Well, I tell you, Dave, we have an awesome guest.
We do. It's Imagineer Ethan Reed. He's in the green room, itching to come on the show here. And I think we should get to him.
Let's do it.
Skull Rock Podcast, interview time.
Oh, Al John. So I am so thrilled to have an old friend, an old colleague, Imagineer Ethan Reed, who is a fellow CalArtian. He went to CalArts and spent more than 20 years at Walt Disney Imagineering. And as everybody knows, by the way, whether you're at Imagineering or you've left Imagineering, you are still an Imagineer. There's no taking that away from anybody. And I had the pleasure of working with Ethan on the Seven Dwarves Mine Train down in Orlando, as well as Shanghai, The Little Mermaid, Ariel's Undersea Adventure at California Adventure. But he's also worked on Mystic Manor, Camp Woodchuck, Mini Style Studio, Monsters, Inc., Ride and Go Seek, Enchanted Tales of Beauty and the Beast. I mean, just so many. Finding Nemo, Submarine Voyage. It goes on and on. But more importantly, I want people to understand first, welcome Ethan Reed to the show. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, guys. It's so nice to be here.
Yes, yeah, sir. It's great having you on, Ethan. And one of the things I wanted to ask you right out of the gate was, you know, how did you get into Imagineering? And certainly you were at Cal Arts. And were you studying animation at Cal Arts? And did you always think you were going to go into animation? Or did you have your sights set on Imagineering?
Yeah, it's funny. It's like, you know, the story goes way back for me. It actually starts with my parents. My parents were, you know, baby boomers. They grew up watching the Mickey Mouse Club. Their honeymoon was to Disneyland. My dad grew up in the Bronx in New York, and he got to go to the World's Fair, you know, all that stuff. He loved that. Great memories. He also, you know, used to tell me stories about Freedom Land, which was in the Bronx. And, you know, my mom grew up in San Francisco Bay Area. They met and they were, you know, both grew up watching Mickey Mouse Club, things like that. So they were huge Disney fans. And so as a kid, we had Disney Magazine or Disney News, which was like in the house. And I would read that, like, you know, every month when it came out, and there was always a piece of art in there, and it was always inspiring. But you know, for me, I think animation was what got me interested first, but it goes back to the 1984 Academy Awards. I was in elementary school, and Clarence Nash got a special Academy Award for being the voice of Donald Duck. And he goes out there on stage, and I was pretty young still. And, you know, in my mind, you know, I still thought cartoon characters were real. And here's this, you know, kindly, you know, old gentleman up there on stage with the walk around character of Donald Duck. And, you know, he accepts this Academy Award, but he does it as Donald Duck. And my mind was blown. I'm like, whoa, a guy does this for a living. That's amazing. And I kid you not, I sat there on the floor in my parents' like living room watching this guy talking like Donald Duck. And I'm like, and I just started mimicking him. So I just started like going, wah, 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 just started doing that. And, you know, and then of course I'm in elementary school. So I started talking like Donald Duck and, you know, class clown, just had fun with it. And I think I was about in the fifth grade or so. And my dad, you know, I was, you know, my schoolwork wasn't going so well. Dad had to have a sit down talk with me, you know, get me back on the, you know, the straight path. And you know, he's like, "What, well, you know, Ethan, what do you want to do when you grow up?" I said, "Well, I want to be the voice of Donald Duck." Right. So that's what I said. And he's like, "You know, that's great, Ethan. You know, there's been like, you know, two people have done this, Clarence Nash and Tony Anselmo." So there had just been an article written about Tony Anselmo, the new voice of Donald Duck, right, that was in Disney News. And I had read it, and you know, and my dad had read it, and it's, and you know, my dad said, "Well, you know, the guy who's the voice of Donald Duck, he has something to fall back on. He's not just the voice of Donald Duck." Like, and I said, "Well, what is he?" And you know, my dad said, "Well, he's an animator." And I said, "Well, that sounds like fun. I'll do that." So I just started drawing, and I think I might have told Tony the story once when I bumped into him. At a,
we had Tony on a number of months ago on the show, and he's such a great interview and a great guy.
Yeah, so it was just, you know, it was really cool that you know, I think I told Tony the story once, but it was so, yeah. So that was what got me really interested, is, you know, being, wanting to be the voice of Donald Duck, right? And you know, I never did it, you know, professionally. George Scribner, who I think you guys have also had on, yeah, had me record scratch track for Mickey's Fun PhilharMagic and for the Mexico boat ride with the Three Caballeros. So I think, you know, Alec, George's brother, George and myself, we did the scratch track for, the Three Caballeros, which was super fun. So for me, I got into animation, and my parents, being the Disney fans they were, they had a signed copy of The Illusion of Life, right? Frank and Molly signed, and it was like, you know, the nice hardback one, you know, one that was in the sleeve, had the film strip in it. And, you know, so it's like kind of put on the white gloves to, you know, read it. And, you know, it's like, I just loved reading that book and just got totally into animation. And Mark Davis became my hero. And there was a section at the back of the book, you know, it's like the new frontiers of animation. And then there was one on audio-animatronics. And, you know, I just wanted to take in as much of Disney stuff as I could. We loved going to Disneyland as, you know, kids. We lived up in the Bay Area. We'd probably come down like once a year, Martin Luther King Day, and we would just enjoy the park and, nice 3-day weekend. And so I just had my sights set on CalArts. And I did not start out at CalArts initially. CalArts was, it was so funny. I graduated in 1994, and there was, that string of, the second golden age happened, right? You had Little Mermaid, you had Aladdin, and then Lion King. And, people really wanted to get into animation. So CalArts was just like, I remember hearing at one point, the odds of getting into character animation at CalArts was more difficult than getting into like Harvard Law or something at one point in the 90s, right?
I think it might have been true, because they only accepted 30 people, and they still do only accept 30 people per class.
Right.
And back in the 70s and 80s, there really weren't that many choices for taking an animation program at a university or an art school or something, not like today. It seems like every school has an animation degree.
Well, it's so funny because, Glenn Vilppu, who was, he worked on Black Cauldron, Fox and the Hound. He was a layout artist. He was in charge of the CalArts character animation program at the time. And I remember sitting down with him going over my portfolio. And he said, "Ethan, just keep drawing." And he suggested that I go to another school, get my prerequisites out of the way, and just keep building up my portfolio. And I took Glenn's advice, and I went to San Francisco State University, which was fantastic. And they just so happened to have an animation program, which was started by, I think, David Hand, who was one of the animators on directors on Bambi.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that was a really great place to be, because 1994, half of my friends were interning at Skellington Productions, working on James and the Giant Peach. Nightmare Before Christmas had just wrapped. Mm-hmm. And the other half of my friends were working at this little studio called Pixar. And mm-hmm. I would head over there. Some of my friends were render wranglers, and I would just head over there and sketch and, just hang out at the old Point Richmond Pixar studio.
Yeah, I was going to say that was before the campus was built.
Yeah.
The Pixar campus, they were in sort of an industrial center,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. That is one thing that I have learned. It's like, when artists are in, not the best, buildings and things like that, I think they create better artwork. I really do.
I wouldn't disagree. When we got thrown off the Burbank studio lot after Black Cauldron, we were put in a one-story warehouse building across the street from Imagineering in Glendale, and look what came out of that building. Great Mouse Detective, The Little Mermaid, Rescuers Down Under, Beauty and the Beast, Oliver and Company, Aladdin, Lion King. All of those came out of these dumpy little warehouse buildings that we were all stuffed in. And then I think we became victims of our own success once we moved into the big, what they refer to as the hat building with the Sorcerer's Apprentice hat on it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful building.
Oh, it is. It is a nice building. But, when you're out from under the microscope over in a warehouse, creating these films, there's a certain amount of, not to be cliche, but there's a little bit of magic that's happening. when you're not under the microscope.
Yep, absolutely. So for me, it's like when I was at San Francisco State, I did computer animation, I did stop motion animation, I did pixelation, which is, you know, like you do stop motion with your body, right? It's like stuff they used to have on Sesame Street in the 70s, right? Sure. I was at San Francisco State, I was able to do more than just 2D animation, which is what I really wanted to do, right? Yeah. And I did do that, but being exposed to these different forms of animation at an early age, I think prepared me for, you know, the weird thing, you know, at Imagineering, which was audio animatronics. And I took sculpture classes and things like that. And then, you know, I got accepted to CalArts. I loved it. And it's so funny. It's like, because I'd done my 2 years, you know, at San Francisco State, you know, getting prerequisites and stuff out of the way, you know, when I went to CalArts, I treated it as a job. And I've had this discussion with, you know, different heads of the department at CalArts character animation over the years. It's like some people go into the program and it's like, oh, I'm out of high school, it's party time, right? I did not do that. I treated it like a job. It's like I got in there 8 o'clock in the morning. I would go to my life drawing classes. I'd go to the lectures. I would stay till, you know, 10, you know, 11 o'clock at night, go back to my apartment and then work on my, you know, film some more. But I was very regimented and very serious about it. So,
yeah, you know, it's interesting. You said a couple of interesting things here. First off, I mean, you know, the prerequisites, you know, the life drawing and perspective classes and things like that. To me, I often tell people, you know, go to a great community college, like, you know, Santa Monica Community College has a great art program. And there's so many of them around the country. Go there and do your prerequisites. You'll save a bundle of dough. Mm-hmm. And then once those are out of the way, transfer to a program like the character animation program at CalArts. And CalArts is the kind of school that you're going to get out of it what you put into it. And that's what, you know, a lot of people have to realize. You know, you're paying a lot of money to go to a school like CalArts. You want to get as much out of that as possible. And you're only going to do that by what you put into it. And,
absolutely.
And it's so true. It's not about showing up and saying, hey, it's party time. I've moved away from mom and dad. It's time to party. It's time to work.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's funny. It's like when I got accepted, you know, I was so happy. You know, I was over the moon when I got accepted to CalArts. In fact, my part-time job when I was in San Francisco State was working at the Disney Gallery in downtown San Francisco. And so I was a Disney Store cast member. In fact, that's where I met my wife. We were both Disney Store cast members.
Wow.
And so we're a very Disney family. And it was interesting because, I mean, I got to meet Ivan Earle. Ivan Earle would come in for signings. You know, Tom Bancroft would come in. It's like he had his like Beauty and the Beast crew jacket on and I would just chat with him. I remember having a very long conversation with Ed Catmull, like in the gallery. He was like looking at artwork on the wall and, you know, it's like part of a Disney Store cast member at the time. It's like you engaged with the guests and you would chat with them, talk to them about the artwork and stuff. And yeah, I remember talking to this guy and he had this basket full of Toy Story mugs. And we didn't have much Toy Story merchandise. It was like one of the first things we got in, but his basket was full. I'm like, did you happen to work on Toy Story? He's like, oh, I run Pixar. I'm like, doesn't John Lasseter do that? It's like, well, I'm John's boss. I'm like, oh, okay. But he's super nice, down to earth guy. Great conversation with him. And I told him I'd be going to CalArts. He's like, oh, my son's going to be going there as well. So I went to school with Ed's son, which was fun.
But, awesome.
So
from there, you know, you go to CalArts, you finish the program, and or did you? I always have to qualify that because so many people have been pinched out of the program before they actually finish.
You know, it's funny because I think it was like the first month I was at CalArts, there was a Disney Day, and all of the recruiters from the different wings of Disney came and they were set up in the main gallery there. And, you know, like they were handing out brochures and stuff. So there was feature animation, TV animation, and Imagineering was there. And, you know, I got the Imagineering postcard and had the beautiful Tom Moore's artwork of the, you know, the castle, you know, Sleeping Beauty castle. I'm like, oh, this is great. And, a couple of my friends at Cal Arts, they had actually, through the Ryman Arts program, had interned at Imagineering. And, you know, I, you know, read the books, and, you know, Mark Davis was my idol. The way I thought it was going to work for me is I thought I'd, you know, get a job and clean up animation or something at the studio, work my way up, maybe become an animator like in my 40s, right? And then I thought before I retired, like maybe my late 50s, right? Maybe I'd be good enough to get into WDI. Like that was that in my brain, that is how it was going to go. And, you know, so I got this little Imagineering postcard, and then, you know, was it the, we had, yeah, so they gave us all this stuff, and then it was like at the end of the year, Disney Day happened again. You put your portfolio out, and I put my portfolio out. I was put on the callback list for feature animation, and I think it was because I actually had some CG experience at the time. You know, CalArts character animation was really not teaching any computer animation now, but back then there was very few of us who had any experience with it, and I think Dinosaur was going into production. They needed animators for Dinosaur. So I was like one of four people put on this callback list for Dinosaur. And then there was a callback list for Imagineering. And I looked at it and it's like, oh, I'm not on the list for Imagineering. Oh, that's sad. Cause I really just wanted an internship. Right.
Yeah.
It was my first year at Cal Arts, and I was walking through the gallery, and they had a video cart, right? You didn't have iPads and things back then. Sure. And someone was playing video footage of Sir from Alien Encounter, which was an A100 figure. Sure. And beautifully animated. And you know, I just remember watching them like, that's amazing. And you know, it was pretty cool. So I talked to the lady afterwards, after, you know, they were done interviewing the people they'd put on the list. And she's like, oh, that's great. And one of the guys I'd gone to San Francisco State with, David Gottlieb, who actually worked on Seven Dwarfs Mine Train with us, he had started at Imagineering in the show programming department.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was enjoying animating the animatronic figures. And, you know, next thing I know, I was called in for it was called a 3-day test. And basically what happened is I went to our Tahunga facility, which was the production facility for, you know, Imagineering. And there was what was called the training lab. And in the training lab, there was a A100 figure, and, you know, it had no skin. It was basically just the robotic innards. And there was an animation console and this big giant refrigerator thing with blinky lights on it, which was the control cabinet for the figure. And you were given a CD, a programming CD called Pieces of Eight. And there was eight different tracks. They were each like 10 or 15 seconds long. And it was park audio. So it was like the ship captain from Pirates of the Caribbean, Chief Joseph from The American Adventure, like just different bits of dialogue, the Wicked Witch from The Great Movie Ride. And, you know, you had to pick a piece of, you know, dialogue. And I picked The Wicked Witch of the West because I think they just released The Wizard of Oz in the theater for like the 75th anniversary. And my wife and I had just seen it at, you know, the Chinese theater. So I was kind of into it again. And, you know, Margaret Hamilton's performance is just amazing. So I just, you know, got in there, and I'm sitting there in front of this thing, like totally like, you know, like, what am I going to do? I've never animated on a console, right? I mean, it's like an Etch-a-Sketch. You've got these knobs on it, sure. Right? And, you know, but it's like, it's the same fundamentals. It's like, you do your thumbnail sketches, you figure out what your poses are, right? Yeah. And then you start doing the in-betweens. And the great thing about that animation console is it was developed by, you know, animators like Wayne Rogers, Bill Justice, guys who worked with Walt. And, you know, they not only invented what we know of as character animation, but they invented this whole new medium, which was audio animatronics.
Sure.
So, you know, like there's buttons on the console. It's like mid-in-between, right? I mean, it's like, and it's all... it was all based in 2D animation, which was really interesting to me. So I did my 10 seconds. They liked it. And in January of 1999, they said, You can start coming in 2 days a week and, you know, start learning how to animate figures. So I did. So I was still at CalArts. I did not finish my final, you know, film that year. Because I was enjoying doing animatronic stuff so much that they're like, well, do you want to come in more? I'm like, sure. Can I come in 3 days a week? So, I graduated and, went right into production on Sinbad for Tokyo Disney Sea.
Wow, that's fantastic. Let me ask you this question. You get in as an intern and it's supposed to be for 6 weeks or whatever, and it turns into 20 plus years, 22 years or something like that. But at what point did somebody come to you and say, hey, can you do some character design work? Because you weren't just animating the AA figures, you were also doing character design, storyboarding, you've art directed, you've worn a lot of different hats.
And I think that's absolutely. And I think that's what has, you know, if you want to stay at an organization like Imagineering for a long time, you have to be able to wear different hats.
Right.
Sure. When I was brought in for that internship, like, we had Tokyo Disney Sea going on, you had California Adventure. And, you know, if you've read the history books, you know, Golden Dreams, which is eventually, you know, that was a film that was eventually supposed to be like the American Adventure with this huge cast of animatronic figures. So they needed a lot of figure animators.
Yeah.
And so they were recruiting and, you know, the Golden Dreams, you know, became the film, and but there's still, we had over 150 figures for Sinbad for Tokyo Disney Sea. And, you know, that was such a, you know, great time. But, you know, calling it an internship, because it's like, there's the official WDI internship program. This really wasn't that. It was basically the, you know, my manager at Tahunga, who was in charge of the show programming department. She needed people. She needed people to animate figures. And you don't come in off the street knowing how to animate a figure. It takes about a year to get up to speed.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So, you know, what it was it was more of training. It's like, I never made copies. I would basically come in and I would sit down and I would basically just animate different pieces of dialogue on different types of figures. So the A1 figure, the A100 figure, my favorite thing that I animated at that time was the Hippie Crane from America Sings. So, he was, you know, if you remember that attraction, America Sings, there was the Joy to the World number and, you know, total hippie bird designed by Mark Davis. And I was like, this is so funny. Because I was going back and forth to WDI and not spending so much time at CalArts, I would miss things. We didn't have email really. You know, if someone was going to come do a lecture, it was just like printed up on a dot matrix and like, you know, taped on a wall. And, oh, so-and-so is going to be doing the lecture. Now, we'd had Andreas, we'd had Glenn, we'd had, you know, all these, you know, fantastic animators, you know, come in and give us lectures. But we hadn't had many of the Nine Old Men, right? And, of course, Mark Davis is my idol. And I swear to God, I came up for a night class after working at Imagineering. And I'm going over to the library, which is like right across from, you know, character animation, you know, A113, right? And there's this giant line. And I'm like, what is this line for? And I look, and at the end, there's Mark Davis and Alice Davis. And I missed the lecture. And I was just like, no, my hero. And, you know, I had to get to my class. And I was just like, there's no way I was going to get in the line. You know, Martha Baxton had already shut off the line. So I was just like, okay, well, maybe next time. So I go to my class. Pretty sad. The next day I go to WDI and I'm talking to one of the senior animators who was training me, and I told her what happened. And she's like, oh, Ethan, don't worry. We're going to have Mark and Alice over for lunch next week. It's not on one of your normal days you come in, but would you like to come in? Like, yes, please. So
I'm going to skip that day. I'm just going to skip.
exactly. I totally played hooky that day. And that was amazing because, you know, at Tahunga, there was, we had half a circle vision. So
right. Yeah, I remember that. Cool. Yeah.
So we were in the Circle Vision room, right? And Mark, and there was like maybe eight of us in a room with Mark and Alice. And Mark had a slide projector and he's taking us through the slide. And it was everything he'd just shown at the CalArts thing. And it was like all these concepts for attractions that he, you know, did not get to realize, like Western River Expedition, sure. Bird of the Gods. I mean, all the stuff that's in Chris Merritt's great book. Yeah, it was just so cool. And, you know, I was animating the Hippie Crane at the time. And because I'm me, after I had him sign my book, he's like, so what are you doing? And like, oh, well, I'm learning how to animate the animatronic figures. And I told him I was animating the Hippie Crane from America Sings. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, I'd love to see it. So Mark and Alice actually came over to the training lab and I got to run the Hippie Crane for Mark Davis. And he gave me some great notes. And it's like, that was amazing.
That's awesome. Hey, you mentioned AA, the audio animatronic figures, the A1, the A100. For our listeners, would you tell them what the difference is? I know that obviously there's different grades of audio animatronics that can do, you know, some of them can do more complex movements than others. Some are, the newer versions are very smooth and more lifelike, but can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the A1 figure is close to the original Lincoln figure was for the 1964 World's Fair. So, you know, all Bob Gurr design pieces. Right. And, that is primarily what was in attractions like Pirates of the Caribbean. And in 1989, they introduced a new figure called the A100. And that was done in cooperation with a company called Sarcos. And they created Disney and Sarcos. They created this thing called Compliance, which was it's a filtering basically. So it smooths out the data, because before I started, everything was just done on the knobs. So you were just turning these knobs, you were doing your poses and you were turning these knobs, but you could never see the data. When I started, I was one of the first people to use a graph editor, right? Mm-hmm. So we called it the graphical editor, but it's a graph editor like what you have in Maya. So you can see your animation curves. When they did Haunted Mansion, like if you watch the Disneyland Showtime, Walt Disney Presents, you'll see Bill Justice and he's sitting there like cutting out like the scallop disc, right, mm-hmm. on the record. That's how he got his animation curves. Right. So there's been lots of different ways that they animated figures, but the console became the main way. I think there is now the A1000, which is all electric. So completely electric. So Hondo in Smuggler's Run and I think the Kylo Ren figures, those are all A1000s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they're just now, you know, Disney developed those audio animatronic figures from scratch. Now they're partnering with outside third-party companies to do more complex versions of the AA figures. Am I right on that?
I think it depends. I mean, we like all the dwarfs that we built, those were all built in-house.
Yeah, those I remember being built in-house, but those were also simpler figures as far as I'm concerned. The only complexity was that we added the Pico projectors in the heads to project the animated facial movements of those dwarves, which to me is still like wonderful memories of working with you guys on that whole project and us bashing together the R&D test using a Wendy doll or a Wendy figure that was sitting around at Imagineering and jerry rigging the Pico projector into the head and using actually Rapunzel. We took some Rapunzel facial animation and projected it into the Wendy face, rear projection on the Wendy face to do a proof of concept. No, mm-hmm. It was like nice. you kind of just bash this stuff together to say, can we do this? And I remember, Ethan, you were there when we showed it to the executives and everybody looked at it like, oh my gosh, this is something else. This is taking it to the next level.
Sweet. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's like you guys, I mean, I think Tom LaDuke and Sherita Carter was like, they were heading up a lot of that stuff on Peter Pan initially. Mm-hmm. And I remember we looked at it for Seven Dwarfs Mine Train initially, and we're like, oh, it's not quite there. And I'd worked on Buzz Lightyear, and you know, I'd worked on Bakeet the Snake for the pre-show for Magic Lamp Theater in Tokyo. And you know, there was this thing that would happen where they just looked like they were glowing, right? You have this glowing face, and we really wanted to get away from that. So, you know, it was really partnering with Todd Mathias, who's, you know, one of our great figure finishers in Imagineering, and some of our plastics guys, some of our special effects guys. It was, you know, getting the black light, getting that balance, right? Because yeah, everything had to glow, right? If the face is glowing, then you're giving away the illusion. It was, you know, just doing that light dusting of, you know, black light airbrush paint on the hand and making it, you know, match. I mean, that's what I think differentiates what we did on Seven Dwarfs Mine Train from what we did on like Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I mean, to me, it was, you know, what was so great about working on those types of projects is working with all of the different talent that comes together. You know, the people making the audio animatronic figures, you know, the lighting artist, you know, the lighting designer, the set designers, everybody, you know, it was just this, like, I always felt like it was such a great team effort that goes into these projects, and everybody is sort of striving to do their utmost best in their particular field of expertise, and all of that just coalesces into something that everybody goes, wow, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, Joe Lancicero was, you know, my mentor for years in Imagineering, and you know, Joe, also a CalArtian, yeah, worked with Walt Disney Animation Studios for years. And, you know, he used this, you know, like this, he had this one thing, and he used the, you know, the sum of all parts, like doesn't, you know, it takes the team effort, right?
And, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you can't do it by yourself, right? No. Especially Imagineering. And, you know, sometimes you'll see like the videos and stuff, and it's like, oh, it's so-and-so, and they're taking all the credit. And like, no, they're not taking all the credit. They just had the camera shoved in their face that afternoon.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And that's usually how it worked anyway, you know, but, you know, it's so true though, you know, to do anything like the Dwarf Mine Coaster, Dwarf Mine Train attraction is a massive team effort undertaking, and oh, yeah, you can't pin it to any one person. No. I mean, certainly the show designer is getting a lot of credit, but then, you know, you've got structural engineers, you got landscape designers, you got all of those people that are, you know, putting their talents into creating that that environment, that immersive environment for the attraction.
Well, you know, one of my favorite stories, you know, about, you know, how much everybody puts in into our attractions, and it could be a vendor. When we worked on Mystic Manor, we had a knight, and we called him Trader Sam Knight because he had, you know, two heads, you know, 2 year heads, for, you know, the little nod to the Jungle Cruise I threw in there. But we had this, so I sketched some chainmail, right? And I was just like, oh, this will look cool. So I did my rough, and then I, you know, tightened it up for sculpting and all that stuff. And, you know, it was that figure was actually produced at this wonderful company in Hong Kong called Art Tech. And they've got factories in Guangzhou in China. And so I would go out there to review stuff as it was being sculpted, as it was coming together. So we'd come to the end of this one figure, and we were starting to wrap up production there. And I'm there in the factory in Guangzhou, and you know, we're taking photos. We're all so happy. Everything's looking great. And the owner of the company, Art Tech, he comes up to me, he's like, Ethan, you know, so-and-so would like to, you know, get a photo with you next to this knight. I'm like, oh, okay, sure. And, you know, it's like, never met this lady before in my life. And like, okay, take my picture. It's all good. Smile, you know, say thank you. And then I think it was like the next day, we were back in Hong Kong. I'm having lunch with the owner of the company. And he's like, thank you so much for taking that picture. Like, why? Yeah, it's like she seemed really excited about it. Like, Ethan, she spent 8 months hand doing that chainmail. Oh, and you're wow. just, and that was like, oh my gosh. It's like, I spent so much. Yeah, I threw down some lines on a piece of paper, right? This lady spent 8 months. That's dedication. She'd work way harder than I did, right?
Wow, yeah.
And it's like, those are the stories that, you know, really need to be told and celebrated, right?
Sure,
it's like people put people all around the globe put their heart and soul into these attractions.
Oh, absolutely. And most people on the surface don't realize what has gone into some of these things and how much time it's taken, you right. know, to get it to a place where the public can view it.
Right.
Or ride it or whatever, you know, and that's really amazing. Hey, I want to ask you, how did the Duffy the Bear come about? Because you're the guy that designed Duffy the Bear, which has become like a phenomenon in not only Japan and Asian countries, but it's really a global phenomenon.
Yeah, Duffy's a huge phenomenon. I cannot take credit for Duffy. I can take credit for Gelatoni and Stella Lou and all of the friends, but Duffy existed, you know, before I did. So, I mean, our listeners can't hear, but this was one of the first prototypes of the Disney Bear. So he had this little hang tag that had a story, and it was about Tinkerbell. And I think he debuted at the Once Upon a Toy toy shop at, you know, Disney Springs, which at the time was called Downtown Disney.
Right, and, right.
You know, this one, he was very chocolate colored, right?
Yeah, and just for our listeners, you're holding up what looks like a teddy bear, but right. the face mask of the bear is the Mickey ears. So you've got the muzzle is white, and then there's the two round white areas around the pupils of the bear's eyes. So when you look at it straight on, you've got that Mickey head buried on that bear head.
And by the way, I just have to thank you, Ethan, because we have so many Duffies at the house. Kristen, my wife, is obsessed, and we actually have the first run of the Disney Bear when it made its debut at Downtown Disney, and we did the whole Duffy event. I think you were there when the new Duffies were being put in. I think, were you not there when they did the new Duffy thing over there at the Odyssey? When they did some new stuff. I thought maybe you were there, but yeah, they had this big pass holder event with Duffy, and they had all this new Duffy merch that they were just launching. Like, here's the new Duffy line and everything. And we got invited, and we literally went home with like a million Duffies, you know?
Wow. That's cool.
But anyway, yeah, we love Duffy.
Yeah, the guy who designed Duffy, or not Duffy, the Disney Bear, was artist Cody Reynolds.
Nice.
So he gets the credit for designing the Disney Bear.
Yeah.
What happened is I think Park Merchandise wanted to bring it to Tokyo. And I think Jolene Cicero was in charge of Tokyo Disneyland Resort creatively at the time. And the story wasn't really, you know, hitting with the market there. So Joe and Scott Hennessy, a great writer, he actually wrote Kitchen Cabaret, if you remember that show.
Mm-hmm,
the two of them, they came up with the story of Duffy. So Duffy, I like to give it to three people, right? It's like, that was Cody Reynolds designing the Disney Bear. And then you've got Joe and Scott for coming up with the story that we all know and love, and like building that Duffy universe.
I love it.
So what happened? And then Shelley May came about. I was, you know, deep into, you know, working on Mystic Manor, and Joe they designed Shelley May, which is the girl, right? The girl bear. Uh-huh. They're not boyfriend and girlfriend. Very clear about that.
They're just friends. They're just friends. Wink, wink.
And then what happened is I was 2 days off the plane from Hong Kong, finishing up Mystic, and you know, I've got all my little plushies here. So Albert the monkey, I designed Albert. And, you know, that was probably, of all the attractions I worked on, Mystic Manor was the most enjoyable project I ever worked on. So about 2 days after getting off the plane from Hong Kong, totally jet lagged. You know, we worked around the clock to get it open. And I think I was still working with you, Dave, on Seven Dwarfs Mine Train. So I was like balancing so many planes at the time. I went to, we had Oriental Land Company was in town, and we did like, I want to say like a week. We had a week of all day meetings, and we just brainstormed what's next, what's the roadmap for Duffy. And that's when we came up with Gelatoni and Stella Lou. Gelatoni was based on my son, who had been taking some art classes, you know, here in Santa Clarita. And, you know, he was 4 years old. All the Duffy friends are about 4 to 5 years old. And, you know, so Charlie Watanabe, who's a writer, one of my good friends, and, you know, Scott Hennessy, who wrote the Duffy story, we all came up with that. And the a whole team, different designers, some designers from OLC, and then Stella Lou. So we designed both of those characters, and, you know, we designed them, and then they went into production. And, you know, Stella, you know, so that was 2013. Stella Lou didn't get released until 2017, right? So
yeah, that's typical, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean,
there's a lot of there's a lengthy process. A lot of people don't realize when they're launching stuff. You know, there's a long runway before it actually hits the public.
Right, and like Cookie Ann, she was released. She started as a dog named Pancakes, and it was, you know, before I went to that first brainstorm, I asked my son, who was in kindergarten at the time, I'm like, all right, what kind of friend do you think Duffy should have? He's like, oh, it should be a dog, because he loved dogs, right, at the time, yeah. Right? And I'm like, what would he do? And he's like, oh, he's a chef. And I'm like, well, what kind of things does he like to make? Oh, he likes to make pancakes, because my kid loved pancakes at the time. Uh-huh. So for a while there, Cookie Ann was named Pancakes the dog and was a boy. But, you know, over time, it, you know, transformed into Cookie Ann. And but again, that was like 7 years until it was released.
Sounds like he needs to be on the payroll.
What?
It sounds like your son needs to be on the payroll.
I know. Yeah.
Concepting is perfect.
Yeah, but it is amazing, though, that it's such a phenomenon, and it started out as just being Mickey's little stuffed bear, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think in, you know, parts of the world, you know, where Duffy and friends outsell Mickey and friends.
Yes, absolutely. Especially in Japan.
Right.
They are like Duffy crazy over there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So. They've got Duffy keychains just hanging everywhere. I mean, I love it. But that's the whole, was it the Kiki Kawaii culture, whatever they have over there? It's just like, it's so cute. And yeah, how can you not? How can you not have a bunch of Duffys like we do at our house?
You know, I want to move us along, because we are on a tight schedule this week, just because of all that's going on. But I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the Beauty and the Beast, Enchanted Tales of Beauty and the Beast, down at that was for Orlando, for the expanded Fantasyland down at the Magic Kingdom in Orlando.
Yeah. So the one, it's so funny, because that, again, things take a long time, you know, like I had actually, we had done, I think it was 2001, Marty Sklar had given us some money to develop new animation, right? And we were pushing towards electric, right? So we had to do, so we were given some research and development money, and we had to come up with some ideas. And we did ultimately do, we did a play test. It was at California Adventure, and it was Miko and Pocahontas. And the ask at the time was, you know, you go to Disneyland, you see Pocahontas, the, you know, actress, right? Looks great. And then you have Miko, and Miko on his own is the, you know, the walk around character. He looks great, but you put him next to Pocahontas, he's a giant, right? He's way too big. Yeah. How do you get them scaled down? So let's do it with animation, right? So we actually had this really cute show, and it was Miko in a basket of corn, and he would like pop up. And I don't even know if there's any videos of it on YouTube, but we play tested for like a week down at California Adventure. But one of the other cons, so that was the concept that won, but I had pitched a thing called Belle's Enchanted Cottage. Mm-hmm. And it was Mrs. Potts and Chip on a cart and, you know, all this really fun stuff. And, you know, there was a Lumiere animatronic figure. There was a wardrobe animatronic figure. And, you know, Marty loved it. It was really cool. And, you know, we did the Miko thing. And I think it was a couple of years, you know, 2011, there was a play test at Imagineering. And it was to talk about this, you know, the Princess meet, you know, it was really originally just going to be the meet and greet aspect where you went in and you had the little cutouts of the characters and they told that story. And, you know, I did it. My kids were there. My wife was there. And then we went and did a little questionnaire thing afterwards. And, you know, I said, yeah, this is great. But, you know, I've got two boys. The boys are going to like the ancillary characters. They're going to like the you know, the Lumieres and the Cogsworth and those characters. And I said, hey, you know, check out this, you know, concept I did. I pitched it to Marty and, you know, we looked at it and, you know, I did. And then, you know, like, yeah, that's great. Let's do that. And, you know, I think I was over at R&D at the time working on the Lincoln attraction, yeah. You know, the new expressive face, which was electric. First time we did had done an electric face. And I just remember doing some like Lumiere sketches and then, you know, just I did the concept sketch and then it went off and became its own thing. And Ted Robledo was the creative director on that and turned out great. And then Ted was actually the overall creative director for the Fantasyland expansion that we just opened at Tokyo Disneyland. And he was the creative director on the Beauty and the Beast attraction.
That's great. I mean, that to me was a big hit down in Orlando when it first opened, right? Because they had a restaurant attached to it and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that Fantasyland expansion was, you know, it was done so well. You know, Mine Train, the Beauty and the Beast attraction, just the placemaking. And I think that is... you know, something that, you know, we're having, you know, started my career out on Tokyo Disney Sea, you know, everything at Tokyo Disney Sea is of this certain level, right?
Oh, I mean, I often tell people it's the crown jewel in the Disney park system. I mean, Tokyo Disney Seas is over the top in detail. It's just jaw dropping when you walk around that park. I mean, yeah. It really is, because there, even the littlest thing is amazing.
Exactly.
Because it's so detailed.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, you know, going back to, you know, Imagineers you never hear of, like Monica Gerber, she was our color stylist for Mystic Manor. She was also our color stylist for Mini Style Studio. But, you know, she worked on Tokyo Disney Sea and she did all the artificial finishes. So like, if you've ever been to the Caldera, if you've ever been into the Nemo restaurant there, it's like all that stuff. It's like, I'll sit there, like if I'm on a business trip, I'll sit there, I'll have dinner and I'll just sit there and eat and just like look at the finishes. And I know Monica did that. And Monica, it's like, I worked with her on Monsters at Tokyo. It's like, she's like the Mary Blair of our time. She's like so great with color. And like, I remember she had this puffy jacket she had bought in Tokyo and she was looking for this right texture. And she took this jacket she had just bought and she dipped it in the paint. And then she starts using it as like a stamp on the wall and just made it magic. And just like, that's what I love about Imagineering. I mean, whenever I go back to CalArts and do lectures, it's like Imagineering is like grown up CalArts, right? Because yeah. It's, you know, CalArts is all these different disciplines. And at Imagineering, all these different disciplines, they get to come together and just do amazing things. And you've got people from theater, you've got people from animation, you've got people from, you know, all these different disciplines, audio, right? I mean,
yeah, you know, I was actually in a meeting once over at Imagineering, and before the meeting actually started, there was, you know, most of the people were there and we were all kind of bantering and chatting and whatnot. And somebody mentioned CalArts, and I just asked out loud, I said, how many people here went to CalArts? You know, and it was like 80% of the hands went up, which was really amazing to me, you know, all from different years, obviously, and things like that. But I have to say about the Tokyo Disney Seas, when you walk through that tunnel and you come into the caldera, and you see the full size Nemo anchored there in the lagoon. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's breathtaking. It really is. It just, no matter how many times I walk through into that area, I always go, wow, this is unbelievable. This is so great.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And it is that walking, like, you know, from Mermaid Lagoon, especially to me, it's like walking from Mermaid Lagoon into the caldera, because it's like, it's tight. And then you just, it just opens up and it's that whole vista. And because it's a caldera, you've got the perfect berm. You're not seeing anything
outside
of that berm.
Yeah. Really,
it's total immersion.
Yeah, it's something else. Do you have a favorite attraction? I know this is always difficult because I get hit with the question, what's your favorite film? And it's so hard because there's so many great memories from everything you work on. But is there anything that bubbles up for you that just goes, wow, that was just an unbelievable experience?
Yeah, Mystic Manor, 100%. Yeah. I mean, okay. It's... I think because so many people I'd worked with over the years, like Robert Coltrane, who was just made Disney legend last year, right? Robert had done, you know, Monsters, both Monsters for, you know, the one for Tokyo, the one for California Adventure. I mean, so many things. Winnie the Pooh. I mean, the guy was like the hit maker, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he came up with the original concept for Mystic. Joanne Cicero was the overall creative guy on that entire project.
Yeah.
We had Jerry Reese, right?
Yeah, Jerry. We got to get Jerry Reese on this show at some point.
He's fantastic. And it's like, so he was our media director. And again, we had Danny Elfman, right? And, you know, going back to that whole CalArts thing, it's like, I remember Danny Elfman coming in. I was like animating Albert in the pre-show. And, you know, Danny's like super excited to see me working. And he's like asking me questions and I'm like, you're Danny Elfman. This is amazing. And he was like, so down to earth. And we got to chat. And he's like, yeah, I attended CalArts.
Yeah, so, you know, I got to say, he's an incredible guy. I had the pleasure of spending some time with him when I was writing the Nightmare Before Christmas book, which hopefully will eventually come out someplace, somewhere, sometime.
Looking forward to it.
I know. so am I. But yeah, no, I mean, incredible guy. And again, it's so wonderful to be able to work with so many different talents on these types of projects.
Yeah. I mean, it was just such a fun attraction. And, you know, we hit road bumps, you know, along the way. We did, you know, value engineering at times, but, you know, we were smart about it. It's like, oh, we have to get rid of this. But instead of doing that, we're going to do this. We came from everything that we tackled. We came to it from a story standpoint, sure. Right? How are we going to make sure the story is being told the best way it can be told?
Yeah. And you know, again, that's the thing that people really need to realize is that whatever you're doing, it starts with the story. You know, whether you're doing an animated short, an animated feature, a theme park attraction, whether you're developing a product like Duffy the Bear, there is a story. What is that story that you're trying to tell? And what's the backstory to it all? You know?
Exactly. And, you know, Mystic has a great backstory. You know, it's part of the, you know, Society of Explorers and Adventurers. You guys have seen recently in the media that, you know, the Jungle Cruise is getting updated. In fact, that was one of the last things I worked on helping develop that.
Nice.
And brainstorms and blue sky and stuff like that. It's changed a ton. I'm sure, but I don't know. I'm not there right now.
You know, that brings up a good point, though. I mean, you've left Imagineering and sort of like what's your view on it? Because I, you know, there was such a group of incredibly talented people who all left over the last year, including Joe Rohde, which was a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing Zoom meetings with Joe from my kitchen on stuff, right?
Yeah,
at the beginning of this whole pandemic. You know, I think the pandemic has, you know, thrown everyone's life and plans out the window, right?
Yeah, sure.
I don't think any of us planned on, you know, any of this happening. I don't you know, I'm glad I'm not in management, right? I wouldn't have wanted to make the decisions that were made. I feel for those guys. You know, I think the company's going to come back. It's going to come back stronger. I mean, I was just on LinkedIn, you know, last night, and a guy who'd been at Walt Disney World for a long time, he'd been furloughed, he'd been laid off. He got a call back. You know, I'm not, you know, saying I'm going to get a call back. It would be lovely. I love it. It's like, yeah. You know, part of, you know, I've worked there for 22 years. But you know, I'm freelancing some places. I just finished the Unreal Fellowship, which is through Epic Games, and I learned Unreal Engine, which is what they use on Mandalorian and sure. Things like that. So that was, I mean, that was like boot camp. It was like, you know, 8 a.m. be on the Zoom thing. And it's like, yeah. We had great instructors from, you know, around the globe. But yeah, I mean, Rhodey has retired, but Rhodey's, you know, he's a, you know, what, Virgin Galactic.
Yeah, I was going to say, Rhodey didn't retire. I mean, he may have retired from the Imagineering, but I kind of view it as he left Disney and he started with Virgin Galactic.
Yeah, it's like, you know?
I don't think retirement's in there. Yeah, retirement's not in there in that whole situation there. But it's interesting because, as we all know, Imagineering has gone through its peaks and valleys, and you know, they had a major, major layoff after Tokyo Disneyland opened, and you know, the same I think after Epcot. So you know, the size of the crew at Imagineering, this you know, ebbs and flows depending on what they're going to be building, and you know, I know they're going to be building more parks, more experiences, and things will get back to some kind of normalcy.
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing. I think people, you know, being stuck inside for a year, right?
Yeah.
I
mean, yeah.
They are going to want to, you know, go out to theme parks. And, you know, before the pandemic, you know, I felt like we were having problems finding enough people to do the work that we wanted to get done.
Yes. And you know something, I think the interesting thing that you just said is that people are going to be wanting to get out. Al John and I at the beginning of the show talked about the fact that Godzilla versus Kong had a blowout weekend box office, the biggest weekend box office since the pandemic began. Wow. It did almost $50 million in the United States, and you know, close to $300 million worldwide. So that shows you the pent up demand of people wanting to get out. This is the tip of the iceberg, my friend.
Oh.
It's going to be an unbelievable summer, because there's going to be a lot of disappointment from people who didn't book things early, or are going to be, you know, complaining about waiting in lines for, you know, 2 hours to get on Pirates of the Caribbean or something at any of the parks.
Yeah. I mean, people want to go do things. People want to have experiences. And, you know, like you think of like Disneyland before, it's like, you know, I had a Silver Pass for, you know, ever. I know we were always blocked out because the park was just so crowded, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
There was demand before, and you know, it's a supply and demand thing. I mean, people are going to want it. People are going to want new theme experiences, and you know, there's, you know, Universal. I mean, it's like, I'm so looking forward to the Mario land opening here at Universal Hollywood. I mean, sure. All the stuff that we've seen out of Japan looks great. Even if we get half of what they did in Tokyo or in Osaka. I mean, it would just be amazing to have that in our backyard, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has really just been a great conversation, Ethan. And I have to say, I really appreciate you coming on the show. And, you know, and I say this to every one of our guests, we can't possibly talk about all you've done in your career inside of an hour. It's impossible. So I'm hoping that we have you back on the show maybe next year and catch up and see what you've been working on at that point. Al John?
I'd be remiss if I didn't say, by the way, a mutual friend of ours, Stephen Stanton, says hello. You know, and we love it, because obviously, you know, Lord Mystic, I mean, he's the voice. So you gotta say what's up. And Steven is a great friend. So he says hello. But I want to know how you feel about the fact that they're going to be making it's apparently a Society of Explorers and Adventurers movie. I don't know if you guys have kind of heard about that. I'm sure you have. It's no secret, but
I think it was like it was reported in Variety or something like that. I read that, and I think it's very exciting. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's like, you know, you develop these things, and you know, lots of people have developed stuff for the SEA over time. You know, Joe Ancicero, Chuck Ballew designed you know, Harrison Hightower for, you know, Tokyo DisneySea, which that story, all that artwork he did is, it's just amazing. I mean, the fact that those characters are going to live on and someone else is going to tell that story is great. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. And if they want to, you know, bring me in as a consultant to talk about how Albert might, you know, react in a situation, I'm available.
I do think it's fantastic, though, because, you know, just the Society of Explorers and Adventurers, to me, that's a universe. You know, guys, I mean, there's you can create so many characters and so many offshoot stories from that, that you've got an incredible franchise that they could do some really sort of Indiana Jones-ish type of movies.
National Treasure style.
National Treasure style. I mean, I'm looking forward to whatever they come up with on that. That's going to be fantastic. Well, Ethan Reed, thank you so much. Imagineer Ethan Reed for being on our show, the Skull Rock Podcast. And we look forward to having you back in the future. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Skull Rock Podcast.
Now for some real user power.
Your weekly immersion into all things Disney.
What a great interview, Dave. Ethan had a lot of really cool things to say, and it was great to have another Imagineer on the show.
Absolutely. You know, I always enjoyed working with Ethan. We you know, as I mentioned, we worked on several projects together, and you know, just a terrific guy, and still has a lot of years ahead of him in this business. And I'm looking forward to seeing what he's going to be working on in the future.
Oh, me too.
Well, I have to say, this is again another show down. And I'm going to be on the road next week, Al John.
Oh my gosh. You're going to have the Boss Mobile Studio.
I'm going to have the Mobile Skull Rock Podcast Studio.
Sweet.
In New York. And I'll be joining you, from New York. And you know what? We're going to be interviewing, Dean Yeagel.
Okay.
He's an animator, a studio owner. He's one of the pillars of the New York animation scene. And so we're going to dive into the New York animation scene, which is always fun to do because it's very eclectic.
I love it. And I'm looking forward to hearing all the great stuff and stories with you and Dean next week on the show. But anyway, gang, if you love Disney, like I know you are, you listen to this entire show, you got to love it. We'd ask for you to not only subscribe to the show, but also give us a like and a subscribe and give us those 5-star reviews if you think we've earned it. Also, those reviews certainly help no matter what podcast platform, whether you listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Google, iHeartRadio, you know, the Anchor, the list goes on and on. But we would certainly appreciate it. And if you share it, too, we'll also give you a big gold star on social media. Also, be sure to follow us on all the social medias as well. SkullRockPodcast.com. We'll be updating that website over the next couple weeks, which will be great. So it's finally going to get up to speed now that we have all these shows under our belt. Kristen's going to let me have the keys and I'll be able to update it. And it's going to be great. You can also drop an email if you would. If you've got questions for Dave or myself, feel free to shoot it over at dave@skullrockpodcast.com or aljohn@skullrockpodcast.com. Any other words before we close the show, Dave?
Hey, all I have to say, Al John, is peace and love to everybody. Yes. Let's go out there and have a great week. Help people out. Be positive and enjoy spring unfolding across the nation.
All right. Sounds like a plan. We'll see you next week. Take care.
I'm Kristen Hetzel, co-host of Dining at Disney podcast. Every week, I chat about dining at Disneyland and Walt Disney World Resort and Disney Cruise Line with my fellow foodie, Bubba. We also feature restaurants and food reviews, information to help you plan your dining, Disney food news, recipes, and a monthly panel discussion. Visit diningatdisney.com and subscribe to Dining at Disney podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. Dining at Disney podcast, the happiest plate on earth.
I'm Al John Goh, co-host of the Disney List podcast, as heard on Sorcerer Radio, as well as Skull Rock podcast, here with my wife, Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
You are an earmarked agent who books Disney travel vacations for people all the time. Give our listeners a reason why they'd want to give you a call instead of just booking a trip by themselves.
Well, I can do all of the legwork for them. I have expertise. I've been to the Disney parks well over 100 times, so they've got that knowledge at their hand, as well as it saves them time and money.
Where can people get in touch with you so that they can book their next Disney cruise, Disney park trip, Adventures by Disney?
They can contact me at themeparksandcruises@gmail.com. I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Al John Goh. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host a Disney List podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. You can even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook. The Disney List podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.